Session number 10883, Reel 2.
And I suppose we'll be carried to an ultimate degree if, which, heaven forbid, we ever get involved in a nuclear war in the future.
The Finnish convoy. And do you remember the sort of idea first being mooted?
Well, when it was first mooted, I suppose it would be mooted to Paul Cadbury, and I wouldn't have been aware of it. But I do remember discussions going on that Paul Cadbury was having with the Finnish ambassador in London, Baron somebody or other. Fairly soon after the Russians invaded Finland, I think, Paul Cadbury saw this as an opportunity for service and got in touch with the Finns, who, after some, I imagine, very natural hesitation, wondering what it was all about, I think did accept our offer of an ambulance convoy wholeheartedly. And we acquired the ambulances. I can't remember now how many there were. I suppose there were about 15 or 20 altogether. There were Ford ambulances, and we set off from England in January 1940, crossed from Newcastle to Bergen. The ship we were in, our first real taste of the more tragic side of war was when the ship we were in picked up some survivors from a Danish ship, I think it was, that had been torpedoed. And we landed in Bergen. I can remember the great impression about landing in Bergen was seeing all the lights on, because, of course, we'd had a winter of blackout, the first winter of the war. And then we went on by train to Oslo and waited in Oslo while the boat which was carrying our ambulances, which had gone separately, was frozen in the Skagerrak. And we had, I think it was perhaps nearly a fortnight, waiting in Oslo for our ambulances to arrive.
How did you use the time then?
Shamefully, in a way, as one felt, really having a winter sports holiday, being taught to ski by Norwegian students from Oslo University. We were billeted in a small pension outside Oslo, and these Norwegian students, Norway, of course, was passionately pro-Finn, as the Scandinavians were, and were keen to help anyone who was going to Finland. And while waiting for our ambulances to arrive, we couldn't do anything much, and we gratefully accepted the help of these Norwegian students who taught us to ski, which did come in quite handy subsequently in Finland, though only on the level. We weren't in any areas where there were mountains in Finland, but we did use skis to get around in the woods. And we had a high old time. The Oslo authorities, being pro-Finn, gave us all free transport on the local trams and buses, because when we first arrived we weren't expecting to be there for a day or two. I'm not sure that they didn't slightly regret it by the end of the fortnight when we'd been hanging around waiting for our ambulances. However, our ambulances finally turned up and we set off, and we went from Oslo to Stockholm. And I remember spending my 21st birthday driving from Örebro, I think it was, in Sweden, to Stockholm, and celebrating in milk in the Salvation Army hostel in Stockholm, where we were spending the night of my 21st birthday. And then we drove up further north, round the head of the Gulf of Bothnia, through Haparanda and Tornio, and down into Finland, where we went to a place called Savonlinna, and were then dispersed into various groups and sent out to work with the Finnish army in various ways. I was in a small group living out in a dugout in the snow, out in the forest, I suppose two or three kilometres from the Russian lines. Not doing an awful lot except transporting a certain number of Finnish casualty back to the base hospital in Savonlinna. We had our first experience of being bombed by a Russian plane, as we were driving back on one occasion. But looking back on it, I think we were only actually in Finland for, while the war was on, probably for not more than 2 or 3 weeks, because the peace was declared after we'd only been there 2 or 3 weeks. So really, the contribution we made during the war was pretty slight, carrying a certain number of injured.
Were there many casualties, you know, from this sort of...
Not a great many on the front that I was. I think there perhaps were in other sectors or had been before we got there. But no, we saw, speaking from memory, I shouldn't think I saw more than 20 or 30 casualties in our ambulances in the time we were there. After peace was declared, we stayed on for, I suppose, another month or 5 weeks, mostly transporting refugees in our ambulances, because the area we were in was in a part of Karelia which the Russians annexed at the end of the war, and a good many of the Finns living in that area chose to leave their homes and move back into the remainder of Finland rather than stay on in an area which is becoming Russian. We did carry, during the war, yes, we did carry a number of Russian prisoners in our ambulances. And I seem to remember one of the Russian prisoners that we carried in, that I carried in my ambulance, an injured or wounded, or, yes, injured, I think actually he was suffering from frostbite, if I remember rightly. I think he'd lost some of his feet, was actually a Sudeten German. Who had been attracted by Russian propaganda before the war and had migrated into Russia, though a German, Sudeten German by origin, and was now in the Russian army, and who, oddly enough, I think I'm right, in, if I remember rightly, had a married sister living in Birmingham, who'd married an Englishman, which was rather an odd thing to find. I was able to converse with him a bit because he was a German and I could speak a certain amount of German. So I was able to converse with him.
You didn't mind carrying soldiers? No, did they have to be wounded before you agreed to take
Well,
them?
all the ones that we were, yes, I mean, all the soldiers that we carried in our ambulances were wounded. We were carrying them as wounded soldiers. We weren't involved in Finland in troop movements at all.
Were you ever asked to do that?
Not there. Subsequently, as I may come on to this later on, subsequently, yes, when I was working with the Free French, we did have quite a row about this when we were in the Western Desert and were asked to use our vehicles, which were marked with the Red Cross, for transporting troops or military materials, or in one case, I think, actually to tow 75 field guns. And this was, of course, anyhow, I mean, quite apart from our beliefs, was against the Geneva Convention. And we stuck out against that. But in Finland, no, it wasn't a problem.
Did you get any idea of the Finns and their attitudes in the war? You know, did they fight very staunchly against the Russians?
Yes, they were passionately against the Russian invasion, though on the few occasions when I actually saw them with Russian prisoners, they didn't appear to bear any undue animosity to Russian soldiers as individuals. They treated them pretty well, as far as I could judge, but they were passionately against the Russian invasion of Finland and very, very nationalistic in that sense. But on a human level, they did treat the Russians, the ones that I saw, really pretty well. But I can't say I had great experience of this.
And the refugees, you know, the people who were leaving their homes, did they destroy, you know, was it a sort of scorched earth policy when they left there? I think
there was a certain amount of this. I did see a little of it. What the government policy was, I can't remember, but I think there were certainly individual cases of people where they couldn't bear to think of their own farms or homes being occupied by Russians, and I think they did adopt a bit of a scorched earth policy. Can't, I'm afraid, remember whether this was widespread or official policy.
How about your own living conditions in Finland? You know, how did you fare for things like accommodation, food?
Variable. In Savonlinna, at the sort of base, we were, if I remember it, accommodated very comfortably in an annex to a hospital or a small pension or something like that, and really very comfortable. The period when we were out nearer the front, fairly primitive, as I say, it was in a dugout, dug into the ground. Of course, it was very cold. It was a very cold winter, that. I mean, temperatures going down to 30 below, that kind of thing. We had a wood-burning stove in the dugout, which was a bit of a fire hazard, but certainly kept the actual dugout itself very, very warm. Food was extremely basic. It was largely sort of soup and certain amount of fish, I think, and a bit of meat, but just living in pretty basic conditions, eating out of mess tins with food brought round by the Finnish army, very largely, among whom we were stationed, and they'd bring it round in a large sort of tureen, and we just made the best we could of it. And so I think from memory it was a good deal bread and soup and whatever was around for that time. But as I say, we really weren't there very long, and looking back on it, our contribution to the situation in Finland, which must have cost an awful lot of money. I mean, at home, you see, we raised 20-odd ambulances or whatever, and we were being kept all that time, was really very slight. But appreciated greatly by the Finns, I think, as a gesture that the Western world and Britain had not forgotten them, so to speak, because I think they did tend to feel that they were a forgotten war, because we'd got our own war going on, albeit nothing very much happening. And they did really appreciate it, I think, the fact that Britain had sent an ambulance unit. I very much doubt if many of them distinguished between us as a pacifist Quaker ambulance unit and a British government operation. It was just Britain had come to their help in some form, and to that extent I think they appreciated it. But really, looking back on it, the help we were able to give, because the war came to an end 3 weeks after we'd got there, was really very slight, but worth doing, I think. And certainly from our point of view, was a great boost to our morale, because it really made us feel that we were being able to be doing something relatively useful.
Could you talk to the Finns? I mean, did you have an interpreter?
We had an interpreter with us. We couldn't talk directly to the ordinary Finnish soldier who only spoke Finnish, which is a most incomprehensible language in which every word seems to have at least 5 K's in it. We had an interpreter with us. Some of them, particularly officers, could speak a certain amount of German, and I had a certain amount of German, so I was able to conduct a certain amount of conversations. Swedish, of course, was a second language for some of them. Not that we had any Swedish, but because it bears some similarity to German, you could understand the occasional word as to what they were doing. But we did have one or two interpreters attached to us, and obviously for the purpose of transmitting instructions and orders to us, this had to come through interpreters, so we knew what we were expected to do. But as for talking to the ordinary Finnish soldier alongside whom we were billeted, I'm afraid very limited indeed.
Were there many hazards in this job? You know, I was thinking of icy roads. And
yes, those lakes. That kind of hazard. I crashed my ambulance driving up through Sweden on the way to Finland. I skidded off the road and ran into a tree. We were constantly having minor skids and spins because the roads were all totally ice-covered and not being rally drivers. And you can judge from the fact that the Swedes and the Finns win all our motor rallies that they're very used to driving in these conditions. So the driving was fairly hazardous. And then at the end of the winter, when the thaw started, even worse in some respects, in that the roads became totally rutted and filled with slush, and one was constantly sticking and having to be towed out by other vehicles. So the driving was extremely difficult. Other hazards, we were bombed once or twice, I think, by Russian planes, but I think the standard of accuracy at that time of bombing was pretty low, and I think the only time I was bombed, the bomb fell about 50, 60 yards away. It was only a small one anyway. Being out in the forest, one had sort of hazards of losing one's way. I remember on one occasion we did overshoot or get on the wrong road from where we were supposed to be going, and finally were stopped by a sentry where I think on that occasion we had virtually gone past the finish line such as it was and were getting quite close to the Russian positions. So there were hazards of that kind. And the living conditions, as I say, varied from the comfortable to the very primitive. But basically, I think we enjoyed it all. We were young, and it was exciting and unusual and not too horrendous and painful, in that the kind of sad sights we were exposed to at that time weren't very many. The wounded that we carried weren't in the main desperately wounded. We did have one or two, I can remember one or two kids, I think, who'd been blown up on mines, who were pretty badly injured. That was all very sad. But I suspect that the interest and excitement of the job for people of our age really generated a good deal of euphoria to go along with the boredom. And anything in war is probably 70% boring, because you're spending a lot of your time kicking your heels doing nothing.
And were you working as a unit? Was the outfit working well together? The sort of, I believe you had section leaders.
We had section leaders. I think at that stage, pretty well. Not entirely so. We did have a sort of democratic revolution on one occasion and replaced one of our leaders by somebody else who we felt was more suited to do the job in those circumstances. And there were, I think, individual tensions that you get in any situation. But by and large, I seem to remember a good deal of camaraderie and not too much friction. Sometimes, of course, we were working partly as a group with perhaps a dozen or 15 of us together. At other times, we were split up, and there may have been only one or two working together and isolated from the rest for short periods.
So after Finland, what happened then?
After Finland, as I say, we at the end of the war, the Finnish Russo-Finnish War, we stayed on for another period of a month, debating what the right thing to do was and how much longer the Finns would want us and whether we were outstaying our welcome. And then in the beginning of April, whenever it was, we heard that the Germans had invaded Norway. And at that time, and I can't recall now the mechanics of this, whether the offer was made by headquarters in London or whether we were able to transmit an offer ourselves from Finland, I really can't remember. But at any rate, the offer was made, as it appeared that our work in Finland was coming to an end. We made the offer to the Norwegians, I think, and possibly to the British at the same time, that we had these ambulances, and we would like to, if they would be of any use, we'd like to serve in the Norwegian campaign. And this was accepted after what negotiations, I don't know, I wasn't involved. So we set off again, back, to retrace our steps the way we came. I remember the ambulances were put on a train, again, to go round the north end of the Gulf of Bothnia. What I do remember about that train journey, which was quite amusing, it was a wood-burning engine which chugged along at, I should think, not more than 3 or 4 miles an hour for much of the journey. And our ambulances and vehicles were on flat cars on the train. The kitchen car, we had a mobile kitchen car as part of our convoy where our meals were brewed up and so forth. The kitchen car was right up at the front of the train, and the one carriage where we were travelling, where the men were travelling, was right at the back. And the feeding arrangements were somebody went climbed ahead onto the kitchen car, brewed up a great brew of porridge. Somebody got down off the train onto the track, holding the great tureen of porridge, waited until the back carriage arrived, handed this up to the people on the train, then hared like anything to catch up the train and join it. And the train was going so slowly that this was possible. So anyhow, we went back into Sweden and crossed from Sweden into Norway on, yes, I do remember, on May the 1st, 1940.
Were there any problems in Sweden?
No, we were civilians, of course, so we didn't present any technical problems of being troops in, being military in Sweden. Having gone the other way, the Swedes were very pro-Finn and made no difficulties at all, of course, and great, great help in getting us into Sweden. They were a bit more ambivalent, I think, about the Norwegian situation, but I wasn't aware of any problems. We crossed Sweden perfectly easily, and we were stationed for a day or so on the Norwegian-Swedish frontier, and then crossed into Sweden, into Norway, on May the 1st, because I remember being a bird, a keen bird nut. I do remember hearing the first chiff-chaff, which was my first summer migrant of that season, on May the 1st, as we crossed into Norway. Anyway, we crossed into Norway, had our first experience of active hostilities in our own Anglo-German war by being machine-gunned by a couple of German planes on the way across. We had not expected that our ambulances marked with red crosses on the roof would be attacked at all, but they were, and we had a bit of a scare there. And then we arrived on at a place called Namsos in Norway, and then were split up and distributed to various parts. Some were sent off to work with the British Army, and others of us were working with the Norwegian Army, and were sent off to a place somewhere, I think about 60 or 70, 80 miles north of Namsos. And our contribution to the Norwegian campaign was even shorter than our contribution to the Finnish war, because, again, the campaign folded up around us pretty well as soon as we'd arrived, I think within a matter of days, probably not more than 4 or 5 days after we'd arrived. The British decided that the situation was untenable and that they had to withdraw. And we got a message one night where we were to say that if we wanted to be evacuated with the British forces back to Britain, we should be on the quay at Namsos by, I think it was 4 a.m., which we realized was probably impossible because we couldn't do the distance in the time we had available. However, we set off in our ambulances and drove back through the night to Namsos, and arrived just after four, I think, to find that the last boat had in fact left considerably earlier, and that there was nothing left on the quay at Namsos except military depots which had been destroyed. I believe, as it happened, that we were very fortunate that we did miss the last boat, because I think I'm right in saying the last boat out from Namsos was sunk with a good many casualties. However, we were there with no means of getting back at that time, so we realized that the only thing we could do was to turn and make for Sweden again, which of course was a neutral country. So we set off, and I do recall that the first 20 miles or so before we reached the crossroads where we could turn eastward into Sweden, we were heading south, and the Germans were coming up from the south. So every time we went round a corner, we half expected to run into a German convoy coming the other way. However, we didn't, and we made the crossroads and then made the road over the mountains into Sweden and arrived back in Sweden, I guess. I'm not too sure of the dates. I guess not more than about 10 days or a fortnight after we left Sweden. So our contribution to the Norwegian campaign was minimal in the extreme.
Mm-hmm. Did you get an idea from the Norwegian troops that you met, albeit briefly, their sort of morale and attitudes to the war?
The ones that we were with were passionately anti-German very despondent when the British withdrew, I think, because I think they saw that that was really the end and they were going to be in a period of occupation, I suppose. They, again, I think, although we were able, in fact, to do very little, I don't even remember doing any work myself at all in the two or three days that we were there. Again, I think they welcomed us very warmly as evidence of support by Britain for Norway. And they were very pro-British at the time. And, of course, subsequently the King of Norway went to Britain, didn't he, during the war. But our contact with them was really very brief. I personally saw nothing of the British campaign in Norway because we weren't my particular group of with the FAU weren't with the British, so I didn't see anything of the British campaign, and there wasn't any actual fighting in the sector where I was with the Norwegians, so we really did very little with them at all.
This journey up to Sweden, this would have been May.
May 1940.
Yes, and presumably the roads were still bad, were they?
They were still very slushy, with snow still melting on the mountains. We had to go over a pass to get into Sweden, and I've got some photographs with the snow banked up at the side of the road above the level of the above the roof of the ambulances. But the thaw was starting and the roads themselves were pitted and potholed and very slushy, full of slush and ice and so forth. So not easy driving, certainly.
And did you get all the ambulances back?
We had to leave some in Norway, I think, and one or two broke down and we obviously hadn't time to repair them. We did leave some behind in Norway. And I don't know what happened to those. We got most of them back into Sweden and presented them to the Swedish Red Cross when we got back into Sweden.
How were you regarded then, you know, having left Norway?
In Sweden?
Yes. Was it?
Well, we were civilians, of course. We were different, in a different situation from some of the British troops who had to do the same as us and retreat into Sweden. And they were interned, a very loose internment, but they were technically interned. We were civilians. We were required to shed our uniform and get into civilian clothes. So we all had to go and buy some, which we had no civilian clothes with us, so we all had to go to some department store in Stockholm, I think, and buy some civilian clothes. And we all emerged looking like the second row in the male chorus of a musical comedy, all in brand new civilian clothes.